Hi and welcome to episode 90 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. I'm Vikram Mohan and we are recording on the 5th of July 2020. Also from Forspire Podcasts, do check out Binge On, a podcast that recommends movies and TV shows to watch online. And also WhatsApp Geeks, our long-running technology podcast that catches you up with news from the tech world. So head over to Forspire.net, that's the number 4SPIRE.net. And now your host Arnab Ray. Hey Arnab.
Hello. Hello Vikram.
Arnab, quick question. Who do you rather have if you had to choose, Trump or Kanye as your president?
Neither actually.
No. You have to choose one.
I would prefer Kanye West because it's just somebody new. With Trump, there is just so many things. With Kanye, at least we don't know anything. So he kind of starts with a blank slate. Other than being, you know, married to Kim Kardashian, for me, I don't know anything about her.
You'll have a first lady who broke the internet.
Yes. You'll definitely have a first lady who broke the internet. Yes, definitely. We'll have a very, very, very famous first lady. That's definitely true.
Of course, very exciting episode. So get us started, please.
Yes. So today we have a guest, and he is one of my favorite, very favorite directors, movie directors, who's working in the Hindi film industry today. And his name, most of you will know him by his name, Vikramaditya Motwani. He is the director of Udaan, which is a list of best Hindi movies made in recent times, no doubt. He's also the director of Lutera, Trapped, which also I believe is one of the best movies, Trapped, made in recent times. Bhavesh Joshi, an initial draft of the script, which I was privileged to see. And, you know, the final movie also was very surprising in the way that, you know, it did the superhero trope. I was very surprised and excited by it, where Vikram took that. And recently he's been in the news for being the director of Sacred Games, which I believe is possibly the biggest budget in terms of, you know, star cast of any of the web series that we have seen so far on all the streaming platforms. So welcome Vikram to the Attention Plus podcast, and thank you for coming here.
Thank you, Arnab. My pleasure. Hello Vikram. Hello Arnab.
Hello. So let's start off with the question. So the first question is kind of a de rigueur question that I kind of have to ask anybody who is associated with the Hindi movie industry nowadays. And it's a very topical question. So as an insider, you know, what is your take on this whole nepotism issue? You know, does it exist? And if it does, what can be done about it?
Look, nepotism exists as much in the Indian film industry as it does in any other industry. It's the same. Doctor ka beta doctor banega, and you know, industrialists will have their kids take over the entire industry, and it's in a kind of way the same over here. I think the only difference over here is that you can't force nepotism in the audience beyond a certain point. Yes, people will get launched. Yes, people will get an opportunity because they're so-and-so's son or so-and-so's nephew or so-and-so's friend. But honestly, if they're not good beyond a point, you know, the audience or the industry is not gonna sort of like, they will get rejected after a point if they're not good enough. And I think that's, at least that's the difference. You're not forced to, a business that's sort of like run by the son of somebody else who has no idea how to sort of like do it, and then there's no option because you're not answerable to anybody. At least you're answerable in a sense to an audience. If you're not delivering to the audience's expectation, you are not worthy of it then. Anyway, that's my take on it.
So you know, that's of course very true. I think what you're saying is that maybe they get to the top easier, at least first time, but then they have to essentially sink or swim. And we have many, many examples of very, you know, Mithun Chakravarti's son, you know, very well-connected people whose sons and daughters whose careers had did not take off, even though they possibly got a movie because they were somebody's son or daughter. And that's true. But moving beyond that, do you think, and this is specifically with respect to, you know, what happened with Sushant Singh Rajput, do you think that even when somebody like him, and I don't want to take names or, you know, take specific instances, but even when you have somebody like him who is a success, but he still will you know, there's still a situation where he might be losing projects to other people who are also perhaps similarly well established, but they have one advantage over him in that they have somebody they know. So both of them are equal in terms of their box office clout or talent, but one always will get ahead because of they know someone.
I don't think that's entirely true. Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do. Look, there's too many factors. You can't filter down. There's too many complicated factors to filter down into a simplistic answer, right? And I'm saying, and from all the history of what we've actually sort of like seen in the industry, there's so many factors. I think the primary thing is that if you're making money for somebody else, I don't see any other reason why people would not want to work with you. Because if you're successful and you're going to make people successful, then everybody will work with you. But there's factors beyond that. Are you difficult to work with? Are you easy to work with? And it comes down to, and not that there's a finger pointing saying that, oh, this person's difficult, that person's easy, or that person's charging too much money. There's so many factors that go into decisions that are taken that you can't really sort of filter it down to a simplistic answer saying that, oh, because somebody else is, you know, friendlier or somebody else is knows somebody else, that's going to happen. I mean, if that was the case, it wouldn't be a situation where so many of our most favorite actors actually in the industry over the years, whether it's Amitabh Bachchan or Shah Rukh Khan, as prime examples, or even Akshay Kumar, as a fact, is that you rise to the top because you're professional, people love to work with you, you deliver at the box office, you are an amazing actor, and you sort of like put in all the work that's sort of like required. And there's all those factors that tick. I don't think it's as simple as saying that you're going to lose a project to somebody else if you're equally successful as the other person just because that other person knows somebody else better. I don't see that as being true.
So you mentioned in your answer that there are several factors as to, you know, why somebody would get work over someone. And of course, the primary thing is, does that person make money? But there are also other factors that you alluded to. So could you elaborate a little bit on what those other factors could be?
They could be anything. It could come down to the fact of, it comes down, I mean, and it always sounds like an excuse, right? When people always say, oh, you know, this, we couldn't schedule it and dates were a problem. But, you know, trust me, that's a genuine sort of situation sometimes when you can't schedule a project. There are creatives, and what happens with a lot of strong-minded people, and trust me, there's a lot of strong-minded people in the industry, whether it's creators, whether it's actors, that kind of stuff. You can't agree to disagree on certain sort of things. When people come with a very, very strong point of view on certain things, and they are completely right in their space of wanting to do that, then it falls apart. So it falls apart on creative differences. It falls apart on budgetary differences. It falls apart on date issues. It could be any of those things. So like I'm saying, again, it's unfair to distill it down to saying nepotism is the answer for somebody's success or failure.
So moving on. So if you recall, Vikram, when we met in Bombay, I tried to pitch Mahabharat Murders to you. I've been trying to pitch my stuff to you for a long time, hoping that you pick one up. And I will keep on doing that, by the way, till you do it. I remember Devanand once said that he will go on making movies till he wins an Oscar. So if he can do it, so can I. So when I pitched Mahabharat Murders to you, I remember you said that this would be something which is... would be difficult to bring to screen, if you recall, because of the explanations that have to be given. The reason I'm asking this question is, when you look at a story, this is something which I need to learn also, is when you look at a story or when you hear a story, what goes through your mind as to whether this would translate well to screen or not? You know, guide us a little bit through your creative process.
Well, the first thing is that, is this visual, number one? Like, do you see this being, like, would it make a cool scene? Would it make a cool shot? Would it make a cool, you know, like, would it be something that is immediately visually arresting? Would this look good on a screen? Would this look interesting on a screen? I think that's the first thing when you read something that sort of comes to your mind. And most of the time, that is the case. The second thing is that, are these people interesting? Are these characters interesting? And then, of course, is the story interesting? And I think that when we had spoken, you know, at that point in time, the series format was not something that we were very familiar with in India. And I think, so you asked me the question from 5 years ago versus the question from now. And I think there's a different answer that's given in both places. And I think that bringing something to a screen has always been difficult, especially when it's not you know, when it's not sitting in the box of what Indian commercial cinema considers the box. So we've always worked outside the box, and then to sort of like fit into that box, you have to be able to either have be very lucky, or to be able to cast a star, or to have producers who really believe in you, or, you know, whatever, your dad has lots of money. So in that's, those are the things that that can get those things made. So I think back then when we sort of like spoke, it was like, okay, this thing is going to be very, very difficult to make, because it's like, how are we going to be able to pitch this and get the money to make this and stuff? Today, the answer would be like, okay, are you thinking movie? Are you thinking series? And if you're thinking series, then obviously the answer is much, you know, then it's always easier to sort of like do it, because series seem to be the place where people want to sort of like go to get more in-depth, more detailed, deeper stuff, stuff that is more complex, stuff that is not as simple, that can be a little bit more evolved. To answer your question, is like, I think that, you know, like I'm saying, 5 years ago, I would have looked at the material and said, okay, for a screen, this is not even possible. Today, you're like, okay, this could be a movie, this could be a series, it could be a limited series, this could be a continuing series over 5 seasons or whatever. It could be a mini something, it could be a 3-part movie. I think it's become broader right now. But still, you go back to saying, is this arresting? Is this something that I think has a beginning, middle, and an ending? Is this something that, you know, can get people super involved? Are the characters super interesting? And then you sort of like take it, I think, from there. So it's a very instinctive reaction at first. And there are things that you read a book and you're like, okay, this can lend itself very well to a series format. Or this is a book, and, you know, you can't really, you cannot really sort of like make this more than what it is. But I think it comes down to pretty much sort of character and plot after a point.
Okay, so that's interesting. So, as an example, for Sacred Games, would you, if this was not for Netflix, would you think that you would have been able to make it as a conventional movie that releases in, let's say, a multiplex?
No, you can't. It's too detailed for that. Like, a lot of the stuff is actually in the fun is actually in the details of it. It's not something that you could make. And I think people had tried it before. There was attempts to sort of like say, okay, this could be a movie, and then you're like, this really can't be a movie. It's too complex for it to be a movie. It's too long for it to be a movie. And I think then after that, a lot of people tried to make it in the US, and I think but because the time that market wasn't robust to go and say, we want to spend a bunch of money in making a show for the Indian market, because nobody knew how that works. Then they were like, okay, let's make it in English. And then how can you make a cop story based in Bombay in English? It's not possible. So then after that, when Netflix finally came around and they sort of like, you know, and the first question I asked them, that, you know, do you want to use English or local language? And they're like, no, local language for sure. Then you're suddenly like, okay, this is interesting. This approach is interesting. But even then, on Sacred Games, have you read the book?
I have read the book, yes. The Vikram Chandra's novel, yes.
Yeah. So one of the first things, like at the very, very first meeting with Vikram Chandra, actually in the room, and Netflix was asking me, like, what is my take on the entire thing? And my first answer was like, I think it's like Gaitonde is fantastic, the character, because it's all very visceral. That's like good cinematic stuff, right? The Bombay gangster from the 90s and all that sort of stuff, and Bollywood and blah, you put that stuff in. But Sartaj is a character that in the novel has been written as a character who is very, very passive. He's somebody who is all like his problems are, it's non-performance, and you can't really explain that non-performance. What are the reasons for it? Whereas, so in a novel, it's fine. In a novel, because you can go into a person's head and say, this guy is just wired that way. He just happens to be wired in a way where he doesn't want to do this or doesn't want to do that. But in a series, in a dramatic series, which is being pitched as a thriller, you know, in a police procedural dramatic series, you can't have that character. That kind of character becomes uninteresting. So my very first thing that I remember telling Chandra and the guys at Netflix was, we need to do something about Sartaj. You need to make him active. You need to give him a reason to be the way he is, and you need to give him something to fight against. So the first thing that we started working on is saying, okay, what are the problems that Sartaj is going to be facing in his life? Therefore, the problem with the wife, therefore the problem with the fact that there is this case that he's supposed to testify on. He's struggling with his conscience on that case to testify. His seniors are sort of against him. You've now given him something that is actionable. You've given him something to really, you know, fight against, and then make a decision. Then that phone call comes, which changes his life, right? Mm-hmm. So you've changed a character in a book, which is a very internal character, to a somewhat external character, which now works for a dramatic series. So that's the, those are the things that you have to sort of like look at and make them. And even in, I mean, in the series world, you always have your character, you have, it's called character arc, right? You must, you know it. It's all about, sure, like you want to take, you have to take a character from A to Z. Like you have to take them from A to Z. And what's that journey to go from A to Z? A to Z, your beginning and your ending of the character cannot be close. If this, if it's too close to each other and if the character is not going to change, then why am I watching this character? You have to be able to watch them take a journey. So how do you, in a, and especially in a dramatic series, I think the most, I mean, for me personally, and I mean, people could have a different point of view, but for me, why Game of Thrones, you know, works as a series and why it's got such a massive fan base and why we all love that show so much is because you're taking characters from season one who you absolutely despise. And then by the time season three comes around, you kind of like them. And the same is true of the other side. Like there's some, there's a character who you're so sympathetic to in season one and you hate them by season six. Right. But you are following these characters. Ask me this point in time what the plot of Game of Thrones is. And I can't tell you in detail, but tell me what journeys the characters take. And I can tell you what those characters, what journeys they take. And that's where the magic of the series world is that you really go on this journey with these people.
I mean, and if I'd, you know, Vikram Mohan can confirm this, but I had discussed exactly the same thing in one of the first podcast episodes where I had made this distinction between a narrative-driven, something which is narrative-driven, which is more Harry Potter, and something which is character-driven, which is more Game of Thrones, where the characters basically meet each other like billiard balls. You know, they come to one place, something happens, and they kind of shoot away on different trajectories. And, you know, the story with Game of Thrones isn't that great. And that's why the ending was always going to be a letdown because, you know, it was never really about the story. It was all about the characters. Yeah. And especially with Jamie Lannister, you know, somebody starts off their first sequence with, you know, killing a child while having sex with his sister. I mean, where do you start? I mean, this is possibly the worst, lowest low that somebody could start. And at the end, he becomes kind of a hero. So, yeah, that's very fascinating. And I absolutely agree. And I guess characters don't get built often enough. I think James Bond is the only example of a character who's basically never evolved till the reboot with Daniel Craig. At this point of time, they do character arcs for James Bond. But before that, he never had a character arc at all. He was the same guy in the beginning and at the end for all the 30 movies.
But I think Marvel's been doing that really, really interestingly. So, I mean, if you were to sort of like say a distinction, okay, well, the difference between a movie and a TV series is that a TV series would be more character-based, a movie would be more plot-based, right? Mm-hmm. But what Marvel's done with the entire the Avengers world and the entire Marvel universe from Iron Man onwards is that you've done a bit of both. You've done individual movies have got the plots that are working, but you know, so you can walk in and see a beginning, middle, and ending and in a movie that works. But as you go further and further into that 10-year tenure of, you know, of the Marvel movies, by the time you're literally starting the last few films, whether it's, you know, whether it's Civil War or whether it's the last two Avengers movies, it's like you're jumping in on a third act. You don't need to establish characters anymore. You don't need to, okay, who are these people? You don't need to know that. You're already in the story. So that's a very interesting experiment they did because it's like a 10-year plan to basically sort of say it's almost like a series, but exactly. Each of these are individual blockbusters that are going to be watched on the, you know, and I believe that, I mean, they got it right. I don't know how many people are going to get it right. I think Star Wars being the other example of that, right? That's like been a 30 or a 40-year sort of like journey. But same funda. It's like you can jump in into those, into episode 8 and episode 9 and not have to really worry about what, you know, who these people are and still enjoy it. But I don't know how many of those will be, you know, made anymore.
I mean, DC couldn't do it. DC tried its best to pull it off. I mean, I would say they had the stronger franchise going in. I mean, they had Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, three of the most recognizable. Before Marvel came in, I mean, we grew up. I mean, I never heard of Iron Man growing up. Only knew Spider-Man and stuff. But knew all these three characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, we knew. And they had those three internationally recognized franchises, and they couldn't do much with it at all.
Yep, that's true.
So the next question that I wanted to ask you was that, you know, I know that you are, you know, you started your life as, you know, writing scripts and you write scripts. So what kind of interference do script writers get from different stakeholders, including big name actors like I used to hear, and I might be right or I might be wrong, that at least in the olden days, that movie stars would come to the sets and then it would be that they would start writing the script based on their whims. I'm guessing things have changed right now. But is there still any pressure, or is the script really bound as in it's just the script writer and the director's vision and nobody else gets to interfere?
Yeah, it's no, that's not, it's never the case unless you're unless you're Sanjay Bhansali, who has that kind of power where no one's going to sort of question it. I don't think any other filmmaker, or maybe, Rohit Shetty or whatever, but I don't think filmmakers have, I don't think it's healthy either, quite honestly. I feel that filmmaking is a collaborative process. It's true, right from the very beginning, from your story writing stage. And I think I've been through a bit of a journey where right in the beginning, it's like, my word is sacrosanct and blah, blah, blah. And you realize that if you keep a closed mind to what you think is right, you're just not, you're not going to go anywhere. The whole filmmaking is about collaboration, and that starts at story. It starts at being able to, every actor, has a point of view, and as they must. And so where sort of collaboration becomes interference, that's the border, and that's the line that one has to be, know when it's being crossed, when it's not being crossed. I think a lot of the actors, if you go further back into the past of your Dilip Kumars of the world or your Devanands of the world, were super collaborative. I mean, of course, and these are the guys. I mean, Devanand, I mean, for the meme that he became at the end of his career. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have massive respect for the guy, because here's a guy who started off, and he formed Nav Ketan. He got directors like he gave Gurudath his break. He gave Raj Khosla his break. Vijay Anand was, one of the greatest directors of the 20th century, happened to be his brother. Some of the greatest music in Hindi movies has been through Nav Ketan and S.D. Burman, he was extremely collaborative. He was someone who would, of course, give the director everything that they actually wanted, but would also sit and work, because he was playing those characters and he brought a lot to the table. So that's collaboration. But I guess when it comes down to, say, someone like a Govinda, sort of like wanting to sort of like change it on the set, on the moment, because you feel that this is working better, that starts to become interference. And I think that so much of it depends, I think, on your relationship with the actor. So much of it depends on how open everybody is. And again, this is like what I said in the beginning. There's so many factors to this that you can't really distill it down to a simple answer. From my personal experience, I've had a wonderful time with every actor. We've always come on board, and they always have. And actors are like that. The joke becomes that actors will have 10 ideas a day. 9 of them are bad, but one of them will be good. Right? Mm-hmm. You have to have the relationship with the actor to be able to be honest with them and saying, boss, I don't agree with all your ideas. But also open enough in your own mind to not have the ego to say, I'm not going to take anybody else's idea. So as long as you find that relationship with them, they will be, the actors will, every day will come out with 10, 20, 10, whatever, how many of ideas you've got. You distill those and saying, that's a great one, but those are not. Right? And that's how you sort of like work your relationship with them. I've also had to sort of like deal with actors, and luckily we never got into, a place of making movies, where we realized pretty early on that this is not going to work out, boss. When we're sitting and reading the script and you realize that, okay, I'm seeing it very differently and you're seeing it very differently, but you want me to go with your vision, which is not going to happen. So let's agree to disagree on this right now, and sort of like walk away. But sometimes directors don't walk away. Sometimes writers don't walk away. Sometimes they stick through it for whatever reason, and that's when the interference becomes, a problem. And actors can be, and look, everybody in the industry is insecure. Yeah, and actors can be especially insecure. And I think that some of that insecurity leads them to wanting, because they feel, okay, this is my strength. This is what the public loves me for. So let's have more of this. Mm-hmm. Whereas a writer and a director are thinking only from the point of view of the character and the movie specifically, and they're like, no, but if this doesn't work for the character. That's when you come into a bit of a clash. And that's when, if you have a healthy relationship, you can sort those things out and work it out. But if you don't, then there's problems.
Yeah, that's absolutely, in terms of, I mean, I as a writer and working with people who are writing the script, I always get into this creative difference. As an example, for Mahabharata Murders, for which a script has been written, for me, when I wrote Mahabharata Murders, it was a serial killer mystery. So the main thing about serial killing is that the serial killer chooses people randomly, but based on certain characteristics that are in his mind. I mean, that's what distinguishes a serial killer from somebody doing multiple murders in an Agatha Christie kind of book where, you know, okay, I'm trying to, you know, get the Lord's inheritance. So I'm just killing off people who are standing between me. And so there's a motive, and you can kind of get those people based on the motive. They're all connected. So that's a classic mystery story. What distinguishes a serial killer murder from that is that there is really no connection between the people except this one thing, which is evident only to the serial killer. And right. I was unable to explain this in a satisfactory way to the people who were writing script and who were, you know, essentially who had the rights to make the movie, because for them it was very important that, you know, the audience sees how everything is linked together. So it just doesn't seem random, which was exactly the point. Obviously, it should be random. If you look at something like Seven, for instance, they don't spend any time. David Fincher does not spend any time in explaining why that particular person was known to John Doe, how they came into contact with each other. They're just shown as dead bodies, and nobody says, but boss, there is a plot hole. How did he get to know the glutton? How did he get to know? Nobody knows, and nobody cares really, because that's not what really the movie is about. It's about something else. So, and I again, not comparing here, but over there, I know that, you know, Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick had a huge falling out over The Shining, because in Stephen King's novel, Jack Torrance, when he comes to the Overlook Hotel, he is not mad, essentially. He's okay, but he's on the verge of losing it. And the whole novel has a character arc of how he essentially loses it. While in the movie, one of the biggest distinction was from the very beginning, he's almost mad at that point of time. So he's further along in his the character arc than was in the book, and that Stephen King actually liked. And so they kind of fell out. And I think later on, Stephen King actually got another movie made, but nobody's ever seen that, precisely for the reason because Stanley Kubrick realized that would work much better on screen, showing what he did with the actor that he had than the vision that worked in his book. So that's a big deal between, you know, the book and the adaptation. One question that I had was on Bhavesh Joshi, which I really, really loved because of where you took the superhero trope, because I was expecting at some point of time for the character to kind of become a superhero, but every time he goes and he gets beaten up again and again and again, which I found was very endearing and a very nice take on the superhero trope. How did that come about? Tell us a little bit about, because I don't think that movie gets talked about enough that it should.
So Bhavesh actually started off as being like literally when, you know, you're living in Bombay, actually that it works anywhere in India. Yeah. You're driving around on the streets and you're seeing pretty much everything. And so I saw that as a stake that, look, we can talk all we want about corruption, about being corruption at the highest levels, but what are we doing really about sort of like our own, you know, moral corruption? And I'm saying moral corruption, but even where little things like breaking a red light, like why do we do? What is the whole sort of line? It really frustrate me when I used to sort of like have this bit, whether it's about how the system has sort of like made us into these people who really don't care for rules and, you know, a lot of that. So that's really, so as driving around in a city like Bombay, I used to get really angry. And that anger was like, okay, I have to channel this somewhere. Yeah. Something's got to give. I have to sort of put this into something. So if you remember the first draft of Bhavesh, it was a lot more social commentary. There was a lot more about this angry guy who was basically sort of like wanting to go out there and do nothing. And he was kind of like, you know, rudderless and anchorless or whatever, until he has that friendly neighbor of his who actually ends up sort of like, you know, dying in this because of this piece of land. And now this guy decides to take that up and become, you know, a part of and to do something about his anger. And sort of like, and that's where it, so it came from there. It came from a genuine place of anger. And I think this was also during the end of the last government, 2010, 2011, where there was so much just general anger about corruption and about the fact that we're just being taken for a ride. And so much of that. So it came from there. And it was just like, how do you manifest this? How do you manifest this anger into something which is, so the superhero, even right in the beginning, the superhero part of it is a very ironic way of saying superhero. It was a little bit of a joke. It was like a little tongue-in-cheek thing saying Bhavesh Joshi superhero. Because the original script was literally about, even before the draft you read, my original draft, like original story, before the draft you read, was literally about a guy on a street. Like, he lives in a street, and it's a one-way street, and he gets really annoyed by the fact that people are constantly coming down that one-way street the wrong way. And so he still got bugged about that. And then at the end of his street, which is a nice peaceful street, one, you know, vada pav guy came over there. That vada pav guy set up his stall over there. And the next thing you know, there's like a whole bunch of people just standing there throughout the entire time. And they're dirtying the place. And they're doing this. And they're doing that. You get really angry at that. So of course, it started from there. Everybody's like, dude, no one's going to watch a movie about a guy getting angry about a street. So how do you end up then making this a little bit more cinematic? And that's when it became about, you know, the land and stuff. And I think that attempt, there were flaws in that script. It wasn't a perfect script. I think there was a lot of emotion in that script, which I really liked, but there was flaws. And then it didn't get made. And I think when it came around eventually to making it, and I got the opportunity because, you know, the studio, Eros came on board because Harsh was interested. And I said, of course, why not? And then I think me and my co-writer kind of said, okay, how do we rejig this for today? You know, how do we look at it? And I think water being, you know, a very, very important thing, and still is, of course, no one still pays attention to that. But again, just coming with the character and just saying that we're doing the superhero kind of thing, and here's a guy super inspired by the superhero space, but it's more about making the attempt than actually succeeding in the attempt. And I think even at the end of that film, it's more about making the attempt than succeeding. Nobody succeeds in anything in that film, really.
Right.
But you have to keep trying. You have to keep trying, and you have to use the justice system. Just because the justice system is broken doesn't mean you stop using it. You need to fix the justice system for it to be able to work for you. And that's what the larger thing that, you know, eventually was that I was trying to say in that film. But I think, I mean, yeah, it is. It's not the easiest film to digest in for, you know, in because it's not simplistic. You know, there's no answers in that kind of sense. And I also feel that the film, when it came out, it was just weirdly marketed and all that sort of stuff. And but yeah,
I'd read that initial script, and so I was, when I was seeing the movie, I was thinking that, okay, I'm going to see that script, and it was so different from that script, and I was so pleasantly surprised, and I felt it was really, really very, very, very good. I mean, the final product was really good, and so do you, I mean, again, I don't know if you ever want to revisit that world, but would you think that would have worked better in as a, you know, a more experimental OTT kind of web series?
I think so. I definitely think so. I think it would have, I think, and again, this is on the cusp of where you're making these movies, because the only outlet you have is to make a movie, right? This is something that we've, and in India, it's just like, you're putting yourself in a box, and not only are you in the box, you're in the narrowest box possible in the entire world, because you have to make a movie, and you can only make it, you have to make a movie. You can't make a series, because there's the television world beyond the soap opera world doesn't exist. And I'm putting this like, I'm just saying, imagine us, you know, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's no dramatic television happening in India. There's only soap operas. So you have to make a movie. Not only do you have to make, you can only make a movie, but you have to make a movie within that box where it's like everybody has to be able to watch it. Kids have to watch it. Old people have to watch it. Young people have to watch it. Male, female, everybody has to watch that movie, because we've grown up on this whole single screen experience, right? Stalls and balconies. Now, in the same theater, you've got the balconies and the stalls. So everybody, rich, poor, male, female, old, younger, all watching the same film. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole mindset, right? It's like there's one audience and you're watching it. Whereas anywhere else in the world, you have films made for kids, you have films made for young adults, you have films made for older people, you have films made for white people, films made for black people. I'm saying there is so much diversity everywhere else, but here it's not. Mm-hmm. So any story you want to tell, you have to shoehorn that story into that box, right? Till, of course, today you don't have to, because the moment, like, and I shot Bhavesh in what, 2016 and 17, I shot Sacred Games in 2017, and they both came out literally within a month of each other. And literally in those 2 years, you saw the entire thing change. Bhavesh tanked, Sacred Games succeeded, you know, in that kind of world. Because maybe that was the whole thing. Maybe I was making Bhavesh for an audience that is not going to the theaters, but they actually are online. So the film didn't work at the box office at all, but it worked really well on online. Like when it, because it came on Netflix and Hotstar, and it happens to be on both those places right now. And people are watching it, still watching it. I still get a lot of messages. I still get a lot of criticism. I realized, okay, maybe the audience is there. But this is something I couldn't know in 2015, that this is going to be. So how quickly that world changed. You know, so I think, yeah, if I had to do it today all over again, I would definitely make it for a streaming platform. I would do it in a sense like Daredevil style, you know, then really flesh it out and open it up. And, you know, do have a, make it more complex, because that's the thing. Like, I wanted to make it more complex, but then because you're making it for the theater, you can't make it over complex. You can't have too many, you know, too many bits to a journey. A journey has to be in a film. It has to be very beginning, middle, ending. Three-act structure, right? You follow the three-act structure. Now, you can deviate from the three-act structure as much as you want, but you also realize that when you watch a movie, there's a tendency to always fall into the three-act structure, because for 100 years, that's pretty much what we've got used to. So, I mean, short answers, I think today I would have done it differently.
So, tell us, if you can, a little bit about your future projects. What are you working on at this point of time?
I am working on, currently, right now, everything, all the work is basically like writing work here. So, it's all, I finished shooting a film in February. It's called AK versus AK. It's got Anil Kapoor and Anurag Kashyap in it as themselves.
Okay. Wait. So, as themselves?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is a movie or a documentary?
This is a, no, it's a film. It's a okay. Netflix original film. So it's a film that I'm making for Netflix. It'll be out sometime this year.
Okay.
So that I finished shooting that at the end of Feb. It was literally like 2 weeks before we all went into lockdown. I finished shooting it. So that's shot, and it'll be ready like soon. So that's what I've been working on for the last 3-4 months. I was supposed to start shooting a series in April for Amazon, which unfortunately we had to, you know, obviously not work on. So that's, of course, whenever that sort of like, that's what I'll start working on. So that's a series which is based on, it's like, it's a take on the Indian film industry from 1947 onwards. It's like a dramatic series.
Tell me a little bit more. It's a take as in, it's again fiction, or is this documentary?
It's fiction. No, it's fiction. It's a fiction take on the Indian film industry from 47 onwards. But it's a period show, which will hopefully last maybe like 4 or 5 seasons.
Okay, so it's about, it's set in the world of the 1940s and 50s.
Yes.
Okay. Very interesting. And in what genre is this? Is this romantic? Is this a murder thriller? Or?
It's a drama. I mean, it's romantic. There's also murder. And there's a lot of that kind of stuff. I can't really talk about it because too much.
Okay.
Because it's like whatever. But yeah, but it's a drama series.
Yeah. So I read somewhere that you were doing this this movie about prisoners, right? Or something?
It's a book called Black Warrant.
Yes, Black Warrant.
Yeah. So it's a book by Sunetra Chaudhary and Sunil Gupta. So basically, it's a lovely book. Yeah. It's about, so Sunil Gupta was a jailer at Tihar Jail, and he spent 30 years, you know, inside Tihar. And so the Black Warrant, the word Black Warrant, the term Black Warrant means is what is signed by a judge when you are your final death warrant, the final death note for somebody on death row. All right. So when they're going to be hanged tomorrow, the letter that's given to them is called a Black Warrant. So it's about Tihar. So essentially about Tihar Jail, but also about the specific prisoners who were there, who were on death row. It's about this guy who was a jailer over there and his story spanning over 30 years. And it's quite fascinating.
So, okay. So that's, I'm really looking forward to that. So, Vikram, Mohan, do you have any questions?
Yes. I did. Yes. One thing, of course, needless to say, Udaan is, you know, I loved Udaan. And you probably heard this a lot where, you know, a lot of people have compared it to Catcher in the Rye because it's kind of like a spiritual adaptation. Mm-hmm. So was that somewhere in the back of your mind when you made it?
There's a lot of coming of age things, I think, because once I know that I want to make a coming of age film, like you're like, this is the film that I want to make, and it's a story about this father and son and this, you know, this small town and all that sort of stuff. Then you start to go back to those influences that you've sort of like had. So Catcher in the Rye was there, and there's also Ken Loach's films like Kes and Sweet 16. There's also the 400 Blows. You know, so there's a lot of that sort of stuff that starts to suddenly become a little bit more significant sort of in your head. So yeah, and Catcher in the Rye in terms of a voice and in terms of that sort of rebellious voice was definitely, I mean,
the angst.
That's always, yeah. The angst has always been an influencer. Of course, again, as typical, my first draft of that was much angstier than what the film became. I think that's a problem I have.
Okay, so thanks a lot, Vikram, for coming on the show. And again, I publicly declare that I shall continue pitching my stories to you, Devanand style.
Devanand style,
because you are one of my favorite directors, and we'd really like to collaborate with you on something at some point in time.
We will, for sure.
Absolutely. Okay. And of course,
thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for coming, and it was great talking to you. I learned a lot.
Thanks, Arnab.
Vikram, are all your movies available online right now?
Yes.
Udaan is. I know Bhavesh Joshi is.
Bhavesh is on Netflix. Udaan's on Netflix. Lutera's on Netflix. Trapped is on Amazon Prime. I don't know. In the US, I think it's on YouTube in the US. Behind a paywall on YouTube.
I did have one more question though. Is there a place where I can watch Chakra online?
Chakra the comic?
Yeah. There was a movie, right? A short or something?
No, Chakra we were developing, but we never sort of like got beyond the point. So Chakra is a comic. I mean, it's a Stanley comic. And I think they did like a kiddie TV series. I had no involvement in that.
Okay. I thought you were involved with that too. Okay.
No.
Well, that's it from my end, Arnab.
Okay, thanks a lot, and thanks everyone for listening.
And keep washing your hands and take care and stay at home.